The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great, sitting here in my bedroom. So hello, Philly.
So am I. Secret thought, we're both in our bedrooms.
You know, it's just like I've never been closer to more people in my space. So I'm good, I'm relaxed, and I'm so happy to be with you, Helen. To be speaking to Philly. I love you, Philly.
So, I wanted to start there. First of all, Philly welcomes you. We're very excited. I speak for Philly. We're very excited to have you. But there's a connection that you have that I learned about actually in your book to Philadelphia, a really powerful connection. I was hoping that maybe we could start there.
Wow. Okay. You just went there. So as I was saying to you, Philly as a city came into my experience around the year 2000 when the Republican National Convention was happening, and I was a correspondent for CNN, and so I spent a lot of time in all the different communities in Philly, plus the main line, and you know, saw beagles and all that stuff on the main line. So that allowed me to have a relationship with Philly as a city. But early in the 1990s, in 1993, when I was a correspondent for NPR, I was asked to go and give a speech, a graduation ceremony speech, at Greaterford State Prison in Greaterford, Pennsylvania, which is about like 45 minutes away from Philly. And so when I went there, I met many people, citizens behind bars, but one of them stood out, and that was a young man. Then his name was Suave. So what's up, Suave? What's up, Suave? I know you're watching. And so Suave, you know, was sentenced to life in prison without parole when he was 17. And he was a New Yorker from the Bronx. I was a New Yorker going down, and, you know, we just connected. And then I gave him my address, and he started writing to me. And I sent him Christmas cards because I'm a Christmas card lady. And basically we've had this friendship, relationship, source, journalist that started in 1993 and remains to this day. Although I was thinking a lot about Suave, you know, before when Suave was in prison. He's out now, so that's amazing. Because of the Supreme Court that they decided that is unjust and illegal and inhuman to sentence a juvenile to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But, you know, Suave just gave me a lot of hope meeting him. And he is now the thing that has kept me more connected to Philly. And so we're doing an entire documentary that is yet to be named. So we can't tell you what it's named because names are an issue. But we're very excited. It's a documentary that captures these, you know, since 1993, this experience that I had with Suave. And I was telling you that this morning I was thinking about Suave because I knew I was going to be in Philly tonight virtually. And, you know, when Suave was in prison and he would call, I would stop everything that I was doing. I would run out of editorial meetings. I would stop interviews, and I'd run into the studio to record my phone calls with Suave. And you know, now it's different, right? Suave is working, he's out, he's right, doing the job. I'm working, you know, so I miss that in the sense that those calls from prison were difficult, but they also tethered me to Suave in a way that it's been hard not being able to see each other since, I guess, I don't know, early in the year. So I know that Philly is so near, but I know your numbers are going up, so we're going to stay safe. Right. And you can ask Suave. I was yelling at him. He was one of the people when I got sick with COVID, actually, because I got sick with COVID early, and I remember yelling at Suave. He's one of the, I had to apologize because COVID actually messes with your, mm-hmm. You become very aggressive. And I had to call Suave and apologize, but I was so worried about him going to work that I yelled at him. I was like, you can't be going to work. You have to take care of yourself. I became such a mother.
Well, I brought him up because he texted me before this to make sure that he was going to be on the call. So I promised I'd do a little shout out because of that, your connection. And it's a pretty powerful one. And one that obviously has kept going for a while. So just so you know that he's on the call somewhere, and I'm sure pretty excited. So, but I wanted to, you know, a couple of things I think I should sort of fess up first is that, you know, this is not my comfortable place. I, you know, I'm very sort of shy and all that. So I blame you and this book that I obviously adore. Look at this, okay? Because in the book, you talk about eating your fear, right? Okay, when I tell you that I adored this book, I'm not kidding. But you said in here to eat your fear. So I ate my fear and I'm like, sure, I will absolutely be on this call with this woman who I clearly adore. So just so you know, so I'm fessing that up. But I want to talk about the timing of this book, right? In preparation for this conversation, I was looking at some of the interviews that you've already given. And one of the things that stuck out was something that you said in 2016, there was something that you said that went viral, and it was, there's no such thing as an illegal human being. And can you just talk to me a little bit about how that sort of set the tone for wanting to write this book and writing this book and sort of the timing around it landing right now? You know, we're a little bit out from the election. We're, you know, sort of at this really pivotal time.
Yeah, so writing a book, as you know, Helen, is really hard. I didn't really want to write another book. I wrote two books early on in my career, and they're just hard. They're difficult, they're challenging. Most writers are insecure, so there's like a whole but I did go on MSNBC on primetime in 2016, and I had this engagement with a Trump supporter, Steve Cortez, and he used the term illegal. He was like, oh, you know, those illegals, or the illegal immigrant. And I was like, wait, there's no such thing as an illegal human being. Illegal is not a noun. And that went viral. That moment kind of took off and it went viral. And I thought, well, I can write a short little book, a little pocketbook, like the kind that we used to pick up at the airport when you'd be picking up your candy or your magazines. And you're like, oh, I can, like, that was my image, that we would always be in airports. And I was like, I can write a small book. You know, the thing is that the publishing industry is an industry, and they love me, but they were like, we don't really think that little book is the way to go. And so they actually wanted me to write a bigger book. That was my amazing editor, Michelle Herrera Mulligan, Mexican Irish from Chicago. And so the idea was, it's not a little book, it's a bigger book. And then it was not just my story, but actually the demand that I reckon with my adopted country, because I was born in Mexico, and actually write the history as I understood it through my eyes, the history of immigration and other policies in this country. So it's a very kind of intimate book, very dramatic, intimate. There's a lot of intimate stuff. But then there's also a lot of history, which I call spinach, but like the best kind of spinach, you know, that's got like Italian olive oil and lemon and garlic, like that kind of, that's the kind of spinach. And that's, I mean, to be honest with you, Helen, when I was finished writing the book about a year ago or so, I was like, you know what? This book is just, it's all been written already. There's nothing new to say. I have nothing to add. That's how I felt. And so it's very interesting that people are like, oh my God, it's timed so perfectly. Because I'm like, that, you know, when you're a writer, you never think anything is, the timing is on your side.
No, but it's, you know, when I saw that you were talking about it in 2016, it would have been timely then, right? Obviously, it would have been timely. But the fact that it's, you know, it dropped closer to now, it was timely on so many levels and sort of at the intersections that you dealt with even in the book. And you talk a lot about the spinach, which I thought was some of the most powerful sort of pieces in your book, because it sort of really framed the conversation that we are having and that we often have about immigration, right? And to put it in that context was, I thought, a stark reminder to the readers, to the American public, to citizens, that this conversation didn't begin when Trump was elected. It didn't begin. It's not going to end regardless of what happens. And so that was really telling. And it was like, you know, there's some real knowledge in here about like, hey, this is the context. This is our history that you were not aware of. And I wonder how sort of aware and sort of cognizant, and I love that dog.
Walter, come back.
Well, and just sort of the thinking behind really inserting that history or those history lessons for us.
Yeah, so that was the part that was most difficult for me when it was kind of like, look, and you can do this, you can write that history. And I was like, ah! Somebody asked me what was the hardest part of writing the book. I mean, definitely writing about my assault was painful. There were moments when I was very much in communication with my father in the writing of this book. May he rest in peace. But the painful parts was actually writing about the history, because I feel like I didn't have the right. You know, I wasn't born in this country. I'm not a historian. How could I write this? And actually, it was the part that was while difficult, was also the most liberating. So, you know, in the writing of this book, I realized, you know, that the first people that were excluded by law from this country were people just like my mother. So people immediately think the Chinese Exclusion Act. Yes, but first it was the exclusion of Chinese Asian women. Women.
Right.
And in the history books, you know this, we were told, well, they were prostitutes,
right? Okay,
sex workers. No, they were wives who wanted to come and be reunited with their partners, you know? So to me, that was just very revealing to just see like, wow, my experience as a Mexican immigrant, my mother's experience is tied to what happened to Asian women. They were denied access. Could have been my mother. And that's something that I really love about the history, which is like suddenly you see yourself in somebody who is quite different than you, and you're like, but we're part of the same policy.
Right. And you really painted the picture of there are no heroes, right, when it comes to the story of immigration in America. Meaning that, you know, this was an issue long before, you know, we started to pay attention, and it's going to be an issue long after. And this precedes, you know, Trump and even some of the presidents that we perhaps liked better, or we were more aligned with their policies. And it's just stuff that we choose to see and not to see, which sort of brings me into sort of another theme that you have is about representation, about seeing and hearing those whose stories we don't normally sort of see, whether we're talking about newspapers or on television. And that theme really spoke to me, and I know a lot of other Latina journalists here in Philly and other places, about sort of fighting that fight inside the newsroom. And I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about, I mean, you broke it down perfectly, but your fight and sort of bringing that representation while you were in newsrooms that weren't your own, because right now you're the boss, which is, you know, the goal, right? Like boss goals. But before that was possible, how did you maneuver that? How did you navigate that fight within these newsrooms?
Look, it was very clear. First of all, it was hard. And I can't believe that Walter is like perfectly posed. I mean, he's really...
I believe he's the star of the show right now. So
I mean, by the way, he's Walter for Walter White, Walter Cronkite, and Walter Mercado. And he's my son's dog that's become mine. And he's really saved my life. I love you, Walter. Anyway, just because, you know, a dog in a traumatic moment is actually really, really helpful. So he was very important for my healing from COVID. So, you know, when people ask me this question, my first job was in the year 1985. It was an economic recession at that time. And so I wasn't so fixated on the fact that I was the first Latina to be employed at NPR in the newsroom. I was thankful that I had a job. Like, I was like, I got a job. That's amazing. And once I got into that newsroom, and I realized how white it was, and how scared I was, even though I had gone to Barnard, part of, you know, the Ivy League, but still I was scared. I never thought I was good enough, which is something I write about a lot in the book, The Imposter Syndrome. And I just said, look, you know, your whole immigrant experience, your parents leaving their country, all of this was not worth it for you to come and be too afraid to raise your hand in an editorial meeting at NPR. So at that point, I understood privilege. I mean, my dad was a medical doctor dedicated to research, so we lived grant to grant. We were not wealthy. But so it wasn't economic privilege per se, but it was class privilege. And so I was like, I got this privilege, man. I gotta represent. I must represent. And so in those first editorial meetings, I literally would hold my elbow and I'd push it up. I'd be like, punch up. And I'd force my arm up because I was scared. I was terrified. And then pretty early on, I got used to people just kind of looking at my story ideas like, that's weird, or where'd you come up with that? Or is that real? And then there were people like, you know, Jay Kernis and Scott Simon, who hired me to work for them on their show, who believed in what I could bring to the newsroom. But it was always a struggle, always seen as circumspect, always, is she really an American journalist, or is she a journalist that has a Latino agenda, as I said in the book, which was just mm-hmm. horrible. Because journalists like you and me, Helen, we actually, you know, our history goes back to Frederick Douglass. He is our journalistic godfather. He is a journalist of color and of conscience in this country. And when you realize that that's our tie to the arc of history, which I realized late in my career, but I love talking about it for younger journalists, it's like, oh, no, this isn't like a job. This is you are part of the arc of history as a journalist of color or of conscience, which you do not have to be a journalist of color to be of conscience.
Right.
But you have a responsibility. So my message, you know, because people are always asking, what do you say? And I'm just like, don't give up. Please don't give up. I know it's hard. It's really challenging. It's frustrating. It's scary. But we need journalists of color and of conscience desperately.
Well, I mean, that's just another sort of part of your book that's both inspiring, right, and infuriating when you consider that, not your book, but the realities that we're facing in newsrooms still, right? Where, again, part of what makes your book so timely isn't just the conversation about immigration, but also the conversation about the reckoning happening inside and outside newsrooms. And so when I talk about it being infuriating, I'm reading this book and, you know, I'm cheering you and like, I can see myself in this, you know, I can see other people who came before and after, but the fact that we're still having this reckoning, right? This supposed, hopefully we're in the process. And so, you know, we all have high hopes and there's all this work being done, but you know, here we are, you know, after you've told your story and fought your way through and came out on the other side and have your own newsroom and your own boss. And I wonder what you think about this recent reckoning and sort of, you know, how successful will it be when you consider that some of the very people or the infrastructure that created the past is still in charge of the supposed future? So how successful are we going to
and you named it. Wow, you're really brilliant, Helen. Are you a journalist? Yeah, exactly. So why are we in the mess that we're in? Just specifically around the issue of immigration.
Right.
Okay. So with all due respect to white men, cis male, white men, heterosexual, of privilege, some of whom are my best friends. But they run and own most of the news media that we all consume, almost like all of it, basically, okay? So while we would like to imagine that Walter Cronkite, to get back to Walter Cronkite, kind of had like the perfect image of objectivity. Actually, they don't. White men do not own objectivity. They see the world through their eyes of privilege.
Sure.
So over my lifetime, these news media organizations and the men who run them have been subjected to the same narrative about Latinos and immigrants that we've been hearing and building up really, you know, slowly, but really taking off in the 1990s. Because, you know, Ronald Reagan was actually liked Latinos and immigrants. George H.W. Bush did as well. It is the truth. You have to realize that they have been part of that narrative. They believe it. So So you and I, Helen, are in our newsrooms constantly having to say, like, no, that's not. See, if you would have had immigrant and Latino and POC journalists in your newsrooms throughout, then maybe we wouldn't be having this problem.
Right, exactly.
Right. So imagine for a second, Helen, imagine if you and I were running the newspapers, let's just say to harken back to original gangster days of like a newspaper, and we were deciding on headlines about Latinos and immigrants. We'd be saying things like, oh my God, Latinas are the most powerful consumer in the United States of America. If you reach a Latina consumer, your product is going to take off. Because we know this, right? Oh my God, Latinos have surpassed white kids and black kids at going straight from high school to college. What? Latinos are gonna be they're gonna sustain higher education. Oh my God, Latinos are, you know, if we would be really special, like, wow, if we actually discuss about this more open relationship between the United States and the South, we would have all kinds of really fascinating people coming here, Guatemalans, like from the highlands where you go to visit them, but instead now we are all painted as a threat. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't gotten better, it's gotten worse. And now our job in the newsroom has actually gotten 10 times harder. And whether or not the white men in the newsrooms, that's because we're basically saying, we love you, but you're part of the problem. So can you like move to the side, you know, do a job sharing? How about like, I'm even prepared, like, how about a job sharing editor in chief to just show that you're prepared to take it seriously.
Right.
Because ultimately we need to do a self-critique, right? We have to look at ourselves, which is what the movement for Black Lives has forced, right? Which is like, whoa, wait, what? And we need that to be happening across the board. And again, all due respect to the movement for Black Lives, but let me just be clear. The original sin was slavery. The first sin was genocide. So anti-Indigenous hate, anti-Black hate, anti-immigrant hate, anti-Latino hate. It's all part of one trajectory.
So before I keep asking questions here, I've been told that I have to remind folks that if you have questions, to please type it into the chat box. And in like 5-10 minutes, I'm going to start to ask those questions. But there's something that I want to continue this before we sort of jump onto the next topic. And it sort of speaks to whose voices are heard. And often we frame that in the voices of the community, like the voices that are heard or not heard. But Black, Hispanic, Latina women have been talking about immigration and inequity and sort of the problems with this administration forever, right? And so I want you to speak a little bit about what happens when those voices, when you're in the building, when you're in the newsroom, when you're on staff, but somehow your voice still isn't heard. And I think that sort of speaks to sort of another sort of theme that you have in your book, which is this imposter syndrome and sort of how to deal with that imposter syndrome when you have this obligation, right? That once you're in the meeting room, the table, the whatever, you need to be heard. And so how do you make that happen?
You connect to your sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. Like seriously, that's the only way that I can express it, which is at that point, it can't be about you. It can't be about how you're feeling. It's because you're there, la voz, you are una voz. And that's why I wanted to write about the imposter syndrome, because it can't be a mystery. Like, we're all feeling it, you know? And it's a waste of time, honestly. It's an extraordinary waste of time. But even right now, Helen, you know, I feel like we as Latinos and Latinas are kind of living through becoming invisible as we speak. Like, we are the second largest voting bloc in the United States of America. We should be everywhere on every news channel, every article. There should be a sense in this country. And again, I go back to actually what I was criticizing before. If you don't have real diversity and representation in your newsroom, then you miss stories.
Right.
You're missing stories, But to me, this, just to be honest with you, with all due respect to my journalist colleagues, it just feels irresponsible to not be kind of talking about the Latino voter. I mean, now we all of a sudden, all we're seeing is Latino Trump fascination.
Right.
You know, I get it, but we should have been talking about Latino voters throughout. I mean, we saw it, because Bernie Sanders would not have been the Bernie Sanders that he was in this campaign were it not for Latino and Latina voters. So even right now, like on days like today, I'll be like, wow, you know, I don't feel heard. I don't feel seen. You know, 545 children have been taken from their parents. You know, it could have been me. I was one of those kids, even though I came with privilege, but it was this close to happening. You know, you would think that people would want to hear from people who have this close-up experience. And it's kind of like, you know, so
that's interesting. I'm sorry, I just cut you off. I'm sorry.
Just to say, pero no importa, al final de cuentas, eso no importa. Like Latinos and Latinas, we need to understand that our feeling of imposter syndrome, that we don't belong, that we're being made invisible, that we feel all of that, we acknowledge it, but it doesn't mean we stop doing this work.
Right. It's exhausting, though. It's exhausting.
It's exhausting. Oh, my God. You know, I mean, I just turned to my husband at one point, and he was like, how are you doing? I was like, estoy bien cansada. And of course, I'm here with energy, and I'm so thankful to be here. And at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, I'll be in the park boxing, you know, so that's how I maintain this. But there is a psychological exhaustion, a spiritual exhaustion, no doubt.
There's something also in the book that you point to, which I think, to be honest with you, is kind of missing for many reasons. But you talk about the sisterhood you have with other Latina journalists, with other Latinas of color, with lips. And you know, I gotta be honest, when in my career, maybe I just happened I'm not in the right freaking rooms, but I'm turning around. And for many reasons, my peers are often no longer in newsrooms. They have either been pushed out or just basically the exhaustion has reached a peak, so that I have, you know, peers who are a little bit younger, a little bit older, but my age group seems to have disappeared in many ways, right? And so, you know, when I'm reading this, it's incredibly inspiring, but like, how do you, you know, I mean, what advice do you have for folks who are in newsroom that perhaps they are the only one still, or one of a few, or, you know, or looking for that mentorship or sisterhood that's not in that newsroom? Where do you go? How do you find it?
Well, something amazing just happened this week, which is that a group of young Latina, early career Latina journalists created a mentorship program out of nothing. They announced it on Twitter. And they're actually doing it because they had that question. Like, we have to start an actual mentorship program. There aren't any. Well, they started one. Right. And it looks like people were really excited to see that. Like, wow, that's great. I mean, there isn't a silver bullet to how to do this. I just know, you know, because there were so few of us when I started, that if I would see a woman of color, I'd just be like, hey, you know, hey, can I talk to you? And that's
Have that in the book, right?
Yeah, that's how my friendship with Sandy Ratley,
right,
who is African-American and the first Black vice president at NPR, three-time Peabody Award-winning, godmother to my children and my best friend, who was a little bit older than me and so allowed me. She was, in fact, my mentor, but we were just best friends. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of make it happen. And I know, Helen, you said you're like, well, I'm a little shy. Yeah, we all are. But that's where we got to get out of our comfort zone to find that group of people or women who can support you. Because, yeah, I mean, LIPS, which, by the way, stands for, when we created it, you know, more than 25 years ago, we gave ourselves a name. We were like, what's our name? LIPS, Latinas in Power, sort of.
I love it.
The S was for sort of. We are in power now, this group of women. I mean, Rosana Rosado is the Secretary of State of New York, former publisher and editor-in-chief of El Diario La Prensa in New York City. You know, we are in the New York Times. We've actually retired out of the New York Times. So there's a lot of places where we are, honey. And so I just got to say, you kind of got to just do it. And one of the things that we did with LIPS was that when we got together, not everybody showed up at the first meeting. We didn't really know. But one thing that Evelyn Hernandez, former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, said was, can we just make this a group where Latinas get together and we don't do anything but just be together? And I remember just like, really? And actually, it was the smartest thing we ever did, because all we do is owe each other our friendship, and that's it.
That's amazing. I'm going to take your advice. I'm going to check out that mentorship program. We're going to see how that goes. Before, I know I have to, you've got two already good, really, really good questions, but I do want to ask one thing, because again, so much of this is, I think, other Latina journalists feeling seen and heard by the stories that you told, by your story, and it's incredibly empowering. But it's also like a blueprint for like how I will live my life by Maria Hinoza. So you do talk about imposter syndrome, and you talk a lot. I mean, that's definitely a theme that goes through it. And while you're fighting through it, and often you have, there's something that I've sort of seen, you know, when I listen to your shows, when I listen to your segments, when I talk to you now, that you are confident in a way that truly I don't witness in a lot of women, and that's too bad, you know. And I just want to know, where does that, and you sort of spoke on this a little bit, but where does that healthiness come from? Like, where, how do you keep that light lit even when your little voices are going off? Like,
how do I keep that light lit? I mean, I really work hard at it. And I think that a lot of this got kind of turned up. Great use of the word. In 2015 was the year when, and I write about this in the book, when it basically all just almost came crumbling apart.
Right.
My marriage, my spiritual self. I lost my father, my best friend, my cousin. My best friend died. I was holding her hand when she took her last breath. You know, there was a lot of ego that was happening at the time. It was making me into quite an angry person. And so I had to do that thing that you hear people talk about, like I really had to do the spiritual journey. And when people would say, I went on a spiritual journey, I was like, stop it. I hate that. Because there isn't a way, you know, to figure out what this is, but there is a reckoning that has to happen with oneself. So I would say that 2015 was that for me. And I really hope that it happens for younger women much earlier, where you kind of do the work on centering yourself and finding your power and believing in that and actually working at it. So doing the boxing, you know, I've only gotten hit a couple of times. Suave was one of the people who actually hit me when we were boxing because I failed to dodge. And in boxing, if you fail to dodge, you're going to get hit. Don't feel bad, Suave. It's good. It's okay. But I remember it, right? So people are like, you're a boxer? I'm like, yeah, but I'm not looking to get hit. I'm just training because I need to feel strong. I also talk to myself a lot. I mean, I meditate. So that's the other thing I do every day. I meditate. And I convince myself to own my power. And that's what allowed me in 2010 to create Futuro Media, which was really risky. I didn't have a job. I just couldn't fathom telling my father that I had gone on unemployment. And so I just did what an immigrant does. I was like, okay, I'm gonna figure this out. You know, and there were people who wanted to work with me and I jumped in. And in that sense, it's like owning your voice and just jumping into the abyss of, you know, something is gonna happen here. And I think, you know, I'm just going to quote Sonia Sotomayor, who is an honorary LIPS member, who has come to our LIPS meeting.
Wow.
A few of them. I know, it's kind of incredible. And Sonia said, you know, for Latinos and Latinas, oftentimes the first act of discrimination that they're going to experience is going to be themselves, against themselves. So we need to really check that out. Now, while we have that, and sometimes nos hunde, it takes us down, we're also badasses.
Right.
I mean, we're also doing this stuff. We are doing it. And you see those women all around you. Even though they may be invisible, they're central to all of our lives. really.
Right, right. And even if they're exhausted, whether we're talking about Latina journalists or Black journalists or journalists of color in general, the fact that we are still in these newsrooms that are, you know, still sort of trying to evolve as we speak, the fact that we're still in there fighting this fight says a lot about who we are and what we feel our obligation is. And absolutely. You definitely are a, you know, a role model for us and you know, for a lot of journalists of color.
I do want to say one thing about Joy.
Joy?
Cecilia Weissman, my best friend who passed away, whose hand I was holding when she took her last breath, was also a journalist. Her husband, Gary Marks, is a top investigative journalist at the Chicago Tribune. When Cecilia was dying of cancer and the brain cancer had already spread, you know, she just talked about Joy. She had battled so much anxiety and insecurity throughout her life. And I just remember her saying, it's about the joy. And I don't have any tattoos, but if I was to get a tattoo, it would be those, just those three letters. And so that joy, I love seeing a lot of women of color on Instagram, which is, I love, I'll see you there. So our joy is our resistance. I mean, me working out with this crew of people, African, Latino, young, old, every day in the park where we're boxing, but then we're dancing together, that kind of strength and joy is necessary. And so you need to find it. Whatever it is, you, Helen, or other people, you need to find that. And maybe it's, I don't know what it is. Mine also includes birds. I've become a birder. I mean, I don't even know what I'm talking. I don't know anything about birds, but I like seeing them. And, you know, so whatever it is, find it. Keep grounded in that joy. Look at the sky. Like in the morning when I'm working out, I'm just like, oh my God, there's a tree in front of me that's 100 years old in the sky. And so this, you know, whew, breathe, right? And be thankful.
I'm guessing that became even more powerful after you were, you know, you were afflicted with COVID. Right?
You have no idea. I mean, yeah, that, so the fact that I'm able to go and work out every day in the same park that helped me heal. Yeah. It's my jam. It's my total jam. And hopefully, you know, New York won't go back to being completely closed down so that I can continue being in the park with my friends. We're socially distant, so don't worry.
I know. I see people get like trying to ask you questions and I'm like, she's being safe. Leave her alone.
You know, I want to say something about that because as a COVID survivor, you know, I take this very seriously and I'm not reckless. So I do, I'm a little bit like with all due respect, please don't lecture me about that.
Right.
Like I live in a city where we set the example and we still set the example. But also respect that somebody who is a survivor and who knows the toll that this can take, knows how to move in the world so we don't infect each other. We're very conscious of that. So I'm not reckless and I feel like we need to be respectful of people who, you know, we're not reckless, please. By the way, I'm also one of those people who don't have parties inside. Like definitely, like I know people who are doing that. In nuestra comunidad, and I'm terrified. So right. I think there's a big difference between a gathering in a park where you're socially distant and kind of a more like active social life of which I don't see anyone.
Right. So we have some really good questions and I want to make sure that these folks get in here. So I'm just going to use first names, which I, you know, somebody let me know if that's not allowed because I'm about to like, you know. So the first question is from Abby. She says, there is a job that I've been fighting for and I've been doing the job without the title, pay, and now without the respect. Ooh, I felt that. My gut tells me not to take the job because I know the person in charge doesn't really like me or want the best for me, but it's what I've been fighting for. What should I do? Someone told me last week, you've changed the culture of this newsroom. I feel like I can't stop fighting until what's right is right.
It feels like you gotta stay and do the fight. Because it feels like this is a newsroom where you've really wanted to be, where you feel like you should be. So, you know, my initial reaction was like, bete, go find another competing job.
Right.
Like, go do that, right? But then you talked about how this is a job that you've always wanted and you want to be present. You're changing the culture. So I'm like, well, if you know it well, you know, and you feel like you're able to change, then maybe you need to stay there a little while longer and meditate so you can get through dealing with somebody who doesn't see you. It's very interesting when I get these kinds of questions, Helen, because I'm like, it's been a long time since I've had to deal with that kind of a problem. Because I created my own newsroom.
Right.
And I don't mean to like throw that in people's faces, but I am kind of saying, but toy with an idea of something that maybe you've always thought, and maybe you can do it. Who knows?
It feels like she's not quite done. Like
that's what, yeah, it feels like she's not quite done, yeah. Right? Like she's got to finish there and then leave con un moño, leave it with a perfectly tied bow. Right. That when you leave that boss of yours, that you're just going to say the perfect thing with honey on your tongue, that's just going to leave him like, huh? And you're going to be like, yeah, I'm going off. I was just hired by the New York Times.
Right. You mentioned honey a lot. And I was like, I have to search for my honey on my tongue because it doesn't really taste like that. The next one is Melanie. I keep seeing articles and book clubs that use this term as the focus. You use the term Latinx. Does the term Latinx create more visibility for the community?
So I do a show called Latino USA. So I think you have a sense that we're not changing the show title to Latinx USA. With all due respect for the people who moved in that direction, I totally get it. You know, Latino and Latina is very gendered. In Spanish, we often choose the male gender to focus on. So that is, or the male form of the word. So I totally get that. You know, I'm close with many people who are trans, and so they explain to me that actually they don't like Latinx because they've worked so hard to be gender affirming, and then it's like it's gone.
Right.
So I tend to use them interchangeably, and I often use Latino and Latina a lot, even though it's a mouthful. It saying Latino and Latina rolls off my tongue easier than saying Latinx. And I do think that saying Latinx for people who don't really know the community and don't really want to do the work, it kind of absolves them from doing any kind of understanding of what we're talking about. And so in that sense, I'm a little bit like, yeah, it's too easy. Also in Spanish, está bien difícil, porque Latinx está como que, ay Dios.
Yeah, I happen to fall exactly where you do. And I don't know. I mean, that's just where I am comfortable. That's the space where I'm like Latina, Latino. Yeah, that's where my comfort is. Next we have Robert. Talk a little bit about the diversity of the Latinx community and its rapidly increasing and significant population that you made reference to. Although there are some successes, what does the community need to do to wield greater political power with its rising numbers?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that people often are targeting the community. Like, what's the matter with you, Latinos and Latinas, that you're not voting? Right. Well, you know, politics is, it's a transactional thing, if you think about it. You want my vote? You got to come and work for my vote. Bernie Sanders worked for the Latino and Latina vote. I was very surprised by that. I didn't think that that was what was going to happen, but it did happen. And it wasn't just young Latinos like 4 years ago. It was generalized Latinos and Latinas voting for Bernie Sanders because they worked at getting that vote. So it's not really the fault of the Latino and Latina community. As I said, you know, if it was up to me, there would be so many more stories about Latino and Latina voters across the board so that they would see themselves reflected everywhere. And then they'd be like, oh my God, we have to take ourselves seriously. Like, look, every cable news channel every hour is talking about us. Wow. You know, like, you know, we really, so it's not the fault of Latinos and Latinas that we are not, you know, turning out on our own in droves, because again, that's what politics is. It is transactional. You have to work for that vote. The truth is that also Latinos and Latinas are incredibly diverse.
Right.
You know, I just found somebody who I know who is like an abuelito to me from La Frontera on the U.S.-Mexico border. He's like a grandpa to me who just announced that he is a proud Trump supporter, Mexican-American. But you know, I'm a journalist too, so I'm immediately going to get on the phone with him and debrief and try and understand. But you have many Latinos and Latinas who are longtime Republicans, especially in Texas. Longtime Republicans, they'll vote Republican no matter what. So the diversity of the Latino-Latina experience is such, but I'm demanding more from the parties. And I don't really know what to expect from the Republican Party after Trump. I don't think anybody knows what to expect. Right. It could just go up in flames.
Yay. Allison, this is great. This is who inspires you today?
So, I mean, I get inspired by a lot of people. I love Instagram. I get a lot of inspiration from Instagram, just like badasses. Like right now, India Moore, the star of Pose, who's a friend of mine, you know, just posted something. And I'm like, damn, India, you know, a trans woman, you know, who goes by they, like, oh my God, you inspire me so much. So I find inspiration in many places. Certainly, you know, Sonia Sotomayor, I mean, incredibly powerful. Writers like Sandra Cisneros, my muse, my friend. But really right now, the people who, I mean, I'll just mention Estrella. Suave knows who I'm talking about. So now the calls I get from prison are from Estrella, who we just did a second part of the documentary on her on Latino USA. You can listen to her voice on Latino USA. She's, you know, for some people, perhaps the most invisible person, throwaway person in this country. She's undocumented, she's Mexican, she's trans, she's queer, she's formally deported. She's got a criminal record, nonviolent fraud. She's in prison now, in a men's prison in Texas, in a maximum security men's prison. Estrella gives me hope. She couldn't be more unlike me. She gives me hope. The refugee women who I know, who I'm not going to name, who I speak to, who are falling deeper into despair and even disappearing, they give me hope only because of their hunger and thirst for life. So the people who inspire me may not be the people who you imagine that inspire me. It's the people who others may not see as having a voice, but I do, and I give them voice. They are the people who inspire me.
You know, we're close to wrapping up, but there's something I want to ask you because we're so close to election day, right? Because we're in this position that we're in with so much to lose and so much to gain. But I wonder if you could tell us, you know, whether you're speaking to Latinos or, you know, American citizens or whoever, Americans, what we can do now, right? To make life better for everyone around us. What is one small thing that we can do regardless of what the results are, right?
You know, I mean, this is like a, you know, it's a teeny tiny thing. There are so many things, right? So doing this, being involved, reading the book, passing it on, engaging in conversation. To me, democracy is not a noun, it's a verb, it's participating, it's engaging. I mean, this is hard in a pandemic, right? We're having a hard time doing this in a pandemic. But I'm just going to share with you. Okay, so after 9/11, which prior to the pandemic was the story that had most changed my life, you know, I was really traumatized. I had PTSD. When I would see the firefighters on the streets of New York, I was one of those people who would be like, hey, what? I'd be applauding the firefighters. My kids were little then, so they thought it was kind of cute. I basically have been doing the same thing during the pandemic for all of the Latino and Latina essential workers. So the first time that I was able to go out and go shopping, and I was on Broadway up here on the Upper West Side, and I saw Latinos and Latinas in the grocery stores, I was like, paisanos, gracias. Gracias por tu trabajo. You know, so look around you. Latinos and Latinas and immigrants are everywhere in your city. don't be weird, you know, like you can't just, you know, he's like, not about me, but you know how to do it. Just be like, hey, thank you. I see right. you. And then take on the work of helping to deconstruct this insanity and base it in reality. You don't have to say, oh my God, none of that is true, but rather look at the communities that you live in. I mean, I can't remember. It was near Kensington, I think. And it was when we were doing the story around Suave. And, you know, it's a pretty tough neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're an outsider, you're spotted immediately. And some people are like, oh, these dangerous communities. If you speak to people with respect and you look at them, they will sense that. And right now, people really need to feel visible and loved. Certainly Black people, because they have been murdered in front of our faces. Rest in peace, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and so many others, right? Eric Garner, I mean, the list, Michael Brown. So see us. And fellow POC to POC, it is about, yo, I see you.
Right.
I got you. We're in this. We need this right now. We are feeling anxious and invisible. Rightly so. I'm going to end on a joke. I don't know. It's a joke. It's a little off color.
All right. Go ahead. Don't tell me not to. Go right ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So I like to say that I'm five things that this president does not like.
Okay.
Which makes it interesting and a bit of a challenge to be a journalist in these times. Mm-hmm. So the five things that this president doesn't like about me are, I'm Mexican. I'm an immigrant. I'm a journalist, I'm a woman, and I'm flat-chested. It's okay, I said it. Everybody's like, oh no, it's okay. I can talk about my own body. He can't,
right?
But
right.
I can. And I like to make people laugh. It's a joke.
I like it. I appreciate it for obvious reasons.
We have to laugh. I mean,
I'm gonna tell you something. You hit it on, you have to laugh. This is a time to laugh and to find places and things to be grateful for, because it's like the one thing that I've sort of learned is like, it's all about the small things right now, which really you realize are the big things. And that's right. Where you have to kind of live. I really want to thank the Free Library for allowing me to do this. And I really, really want to thank you. I mean, this has been a pleasure and inspiration. The fact that you wrote a book where you clearly see us and hear us and inspire us. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen, and to the Free Library. Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure. I can't wait to do this again in person, in real life, as soon as we can.
That's a date.
It's a date.
See you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.